Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City or in Ireland or somewhere else further afield, sit back and relax. Agus fáilte isteach. For this week's show, I'd like to continue our reflection on Seamus Heaney. We marked the first anniversary of his passing on last Saturday's show. He passed away on the 30th of August 2013. And I had a dig through our archives during the week to see what other audio we had of Seamus. What I located was the comments he made at our first annual gala, which took place in honour of Loretta Brennan Glucksmann, our co-founder, and marked the 20th anniversary of Glucksmann Ireland House in February 2013. Little did we know that it would be Seamus' last visit to us here on the NYU campus. It was a wonderful night, and the climax of that evening was Seamus taking the stage and reflecting on his friendship with Loretta Brennan Glucksmann, culminating in his reciting a poem he had written especially for the event. So listen to Seamus Heaney at the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Gala, February 2013.
So what do you say after so many wonderful speeches? Heartfelt, utterly truthful. Anyway, in Irish language, there's a common expression which all students arriving at the Gaeltacht learn very quickly. It's the words banati, meaning the woman of the house. But woman of the house is a mere word-for-word English equivalent, and it lacks the aura that banati possesses in Irish. In Irish, the term suggests something more than an individual person. It's somebody with a natural authority within the four walls, of course, but then something extra, a sense that she enjoys more than domestic status. The term banati, woman of the house, much more substantial than the English word landlady. What the Gaeltacht banati possesses, and to some extent embodies, is the quality they call in Irish duchas. Duchas is hard to translate, but its meaning can be suggested by a cluster of different words and phrases. Native place, your affinity with that place, your affinity with it through heritage or through descent. D-E-S-C-E-N-T, that is, not descent. Well, maybe sometimes descent too. Yes. Anyway, also your tendency instinctively to embrace the values of the place and live by its spirit. So when we think of our own banati this evening, the woman we are proud to have with us and to be our object of praise tonight, those venerable concepts of inheritance, affinity, attachment due to descent, all come to mind. And what's more, in her commitment to Ireland and things Irish, Loretta Brennan Glucksmann embraces the values and lives by the spirit of all the qualities suggested in duchas. But as well as celebrating the woman, we're here to celebrate the house and not to forget the man of the house. Glucksmann Ireland House bears the name Loretta shared with Lou in their days of their life together, and it stays with her now that he is gone. Together, they brought honour to that name, not only in New York University, but by endowing other major projects, such as the Glucksmann Gallery in University College Cork, the Glucksmann Library in the University of Limerick, and the Glucksmann Chair of Irish and Scottish Studies at the University of Aberdeen. And that's only to name a few of the many other causes and institutions that they have helped. The catalogue of their bounty is long and honourable, But this evening our focus is on Glucksmann Ireland House and its banattee and chair of its board. With a family name like Brennan and an ancestry that contained four Irish-born grandparents, inheritance and affinity due to ascent and so on were bound to have a part in Loretta's development. So it's no surprise that a woman from such a background, with early experience as a third-level lecturer in English, it's no accident that she should find herself eventually sponsoring the academy and educational projects in Ireland and America. The Glucksmann Ireland House is a magnificent gift, not only to New York University, but also to the educational and cultural life of the city. The place began with music, as far as I was concerned, and to judge by the Blarney Star concert series, music has been playing here ever since. Moreover, in the 20 years since the house opened its doors, Irish studies have been thriving. Irish and American scholars have brought distinction to the faculty. Visiting writers and lecturers have continued to appear in a very well-planned program, and students have enjoyed an academic and social life second to none. On that day when Ireland House was officially opened, in April 1993, there was a procession to Washington Mews from across Washington Square. A mighty posse of Irish professors, politicians, actors, musicians, writers, producers, they all assembled to be first footers in the newly opened house. We all tagged along in more or less good order behind President Jay Oliva and Loretta and Lou. There was a hint of pilgrimage about the procession, a hint of the academic procession also, and a hint of the ancient order of Hibernians on the march. The only thing not Irish about the event was the Scottish bagpipes being played by the leader of the procession. But anyway, on that day, it was as if history that included famine and evictions, land wars and emigration, as if all that were being answered with a manifestation of survival and a proclamation of renaissance. In fact, another house that comes to mind is what W.B. Yeats said about his life. In his life, he said, he had no house but friendship. And that house is one that we hope you will realize that you inhabit and that it's very sustaining for you and will be there for a long time, Liberta. Besides the banattee, of course, there's another archetypal figure of woman in Irish tradition, namely the Spervan, or the Sky Woman, a radiant apparition who comes to the poet in an aisling or dream vision. The Spervan, for all her beauty, represents Ireland in her subjugated state. But as well as describing the country's woes, she predicts that help will come, there will be better times in the future, and in general, her arrival and her message raises the people's spirits. I don't think there's any need to tease out the implications of the Sky Woman analogy with Loretta, for in her role as co-chair of the Board of Glucksmann Ireland House, as president of the American Ireland Funds, as member of several important boards here and in Ireland, as supporter of causes that extend to peace and poetry, that involve art and the people of art, in all these roles, but most especially as her own wise, benign, and kind self, Loretta intimates a message that help will come, spirits will rise, and she will both be Sky Woman and Woman of the House. I have to read a few verses. They're quite straightforward. Those of you who know about poetry readings know that quite often the introduction to the poem can go on for much longer. Well, you've just heard the introduction. So the poem is shorter. It's called Lauds for Loretta. How can we laud her? Let me count the ways. Her ready smile, serene, attentive gaze, her hostessing on both sides of the ocean, her work for peace when the land was in commotion. Philanthropy unstinted, open-handed, requests for help from every quarter granted. Benefactor with her mighty spouse of galleries, colleges, and Ireland House. That edifice by 15th Avenue, fit monument to herself and Lou, is like a small translated Clonmacnoise, an amplifier for the native voice of Irish writing, culture, scholarship, an answer given to the famine ship, a fish, a court of poetry, a session, academy and legacy, a boon. 20 years ago, a kilted piper, the Taoiseach Albert Reynolds at his heel, led a starry crowd across the square. Jay Oliva, James Colway, Brian Friel, Loretta, Lou himself, the whole Ace Donna, with supporting cast O'Shea, Cusack, O'Hara. That April day, a mark was made in time, as we processed in step like words in rhyme, as Duchess met diaspora and combined indomitable Irishry of mind with the big apple of knowledge. And thus we set a crown upon the labours of Loretta and Great Lou, while Kathleen Ní Houlihan looked down upon this last of Allentown and recognised her as an Aisling gal, a presence, guardian spirit, and a pal. She is foremost of those I would hear praised, said Yeats of Maud. But for us, LBG, is she to whom all glasses must be raised.
In many ways, the creativity of one artist feeds off others. This was demonstrated with regard to Seamus Heaney when Glen Hansard visited Luxman Ireland House in the spring of 2013. He talked about meeting Seamus Heaney, someone whose poetry he'd learned in school, and he recited a Heaney poem. I'd like you to have an opportunity to hear what Glen Hansard had to say that evening.
When I meet a hero, I feel very humble because I see a master. And I forget about the personality. I'm not interested in meeting and hanging out and having tea with them or going for a beer with them. What I'm interested in is their composure. When I was a kid, I left school real young, and I was studying Seamus Heaney in school. Just begun to study him, actually, exploring English. And the funny thing was, within 1 year of playing music on the street, I met Seamus, and I went to his house. And I remember feeling like this was a very potent lesson, that you've left one school and gone into a deeper school, which is the bigger, the real one, where you're going to actually encounter these people. On some kind of, not level, but on some kind of real, you know, to look into the eyes of a master is a very potent thing. That's why I don't like these modern electronic search buttons in cars, because you can't fool around with that dial. Because that's where some of the good magic stuff happens, the stuff that's half heard. And that's a kind of a good way of introducing this poem I'm going to read you, which is a poem by Seamus Heaney called The Given Note. And he wrote this poem about a piece of music called Fort Nabuki, the Puki were the fairy, it's the male aspect of the fairy realm in Ireland. And a lot of traditional musicians have described how they were given their melodies. You know, a lot of the Irish melodies you hear in traditional music, a lot of it is put down to this idea of magic entering through the wind blowing through a wall, a stone wall in the west of Ireland, or in this particular case, the beautiful description of a man out on a curragh. And a curragh is a very light wooden boat, very hardy at sea, but they were made that you can lift them from, pull them in off the shore. And what they were was like goatskin around a thin wooden frame. So when you're out on the water late at night, the skin acts as a membrane to whatever's going on underneath the boat. So oftentimes you'd have whale song out in the Atlantic, and because of whatever way the boat was designed, you'd have this small amplification coming up into this man's ears of something going on below the boat in the deep mystery of the sea. And he would pick up his fiddle in the boat, and he would kind of copy what he's hearing. This is how this man claims his music came to him, and a lot of people claim the same thing. Although Port in the Blue Key is an unusual tune, I wish I could play it right after I say the poem, because then you would kind of know what I mean. It doesn't feel like normal music. But anyway, I'll read you the poem and it'll give you some idea of where music comes from for all of us, because it's not out of the intellect, it's not out of the frontal lobe, it's not through reading, it's through some other tuning out, and I don't quite know how to describe it except to say that. So this is Seamus Heaney's The Given Note. On the most westerly blasket, in a dry stone hut, he got this air out of the night. Strange noises were heard by others who followed, bits of a tune coming in on loud weather, though nothing like melody. He blamed their fingers and ears as unpracticed, their fiddling easy, for he had gone alone into the island and brought back the whole thing. The house throbbed like his full violin. So whether he called it spirit music or not, I don't care. He took it out of wind, off mid-Atlantic. Still, he maintains, from nowhere. It comes off the bow gravely, rephrases itself into the air.
It is almost 13 years since 9/11. As part of a tribute and commemoration of that painful event, I would like to air a podcast that was produced by my colleagues Linda Dowling-Almeida and Michael Stallmeyer, called That Forever September Morning, Memories of 9/11. This is an audio piece that includes excerpts from interviews conducted as part of the Glucksmann Ireland House Oral History Project, and it is linked in with readings from Thomas Flynn's poem Bike Man, which is read by the author. The voices recall the wild emotion and strange stillness of that day and offer listeners a chance to reflect on the events of 9/11 and where they were 10 years later. This podcast was produced in 2011. I'd like us to have the opportunity to listen to some of the voices in our archive on this sad event.
In truth, I missed the first clue, but I do not miss the second. The gunning roar, so close overhead that its maker near touches the treetops whose leafy limbs canopy my back garden deck. Low, loud, determined, the troubling tremble comes on the attack from the north. It tickles my brain, but at first, like a dream after waking, I cannot grasp it, a notion unnoted. It is the fishing line to the fish, a thread unseen. I read on. As the jet skims directly overhead, I can avoid its presence no longer. It rattles and pounds at all beneath. The roar grows ever more persistent. It is a revving up, big effort, runway whine, and gunning for downtown. My eyes follow the sound of the determined attacker. It is a fearsome, screeching hawk as it aims to rip apart its unsuspecting prey.
That Forever September Morning, Memories of September 11th, produced by Glucksmann Ireland House at New York University, drawing on interviews collected as part of its oral history project and deposited in the archives of Irish America, and featuring excerpts from Thomas Flynn's poem, The Bike Man.
Hastily and with a purpose, I load the journalist's tools, pen, notepad, phone, into a bag. A desk man answers my call. I'm off to the towers, I tell him. Go, go, go. I board my bicycle and pedal toward the unnatural clouds rising into the trembling sky.
Tom Flynn recorded his memories of 9/11 in an epic poem, echoing the cantos of Dante's Inferno. His observations are that of a journalist and a citizen of a city under attack. We are using his verse to link the memories of his fellow citizens as they recall what Flynn describes as that forever September morning. In the 10 years since the World Trade Center towers collapsed from a terrorist assault, we have interviewed dozens of Irish Americans who remember that day, as all Americans do, in ways personal, political, and patriotic. For some, it is the tiniest detail of a beautiful fall morning. For others, it is a reminder of the troubles that haunted Northern Ireland for decades in the 20th century, or the loss of friends and co-workers. For all, it's a day they will never forget.
I'm sure, like everybody, I remember it vividly.
Janet Forrester, immigrant and attorney.
First thing I remember was a banging on my upstairs door to my apartment, which was unusual because, you know, no one had buzzed down below. I thought, who's this? And I was going to open the door, and I said, you know, who is it? And a voice said, it's Catherine, a close friend of mine. And I said, Catherine? I looked at my watch, and I said, what are you doing here? Why isn't she at work? And I opened the door, and I remember her standing there looking ashen. She's very white anyway, but she looked completely ashen, and she said, there's been a terrorist attack. And I was like, what?
I was sitting right where I'm sitting now.
Claire Grimes, publisher, Irish Echo.
I just called the office. It was just like 9 o'clock, approximately. And I called. I said, I'm on my way. And they said, Eileen Murphy answered the phone. And she said, well, look, I'm just closing the office now. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And she said, turn on your TV. So I did, and it was just extraordinary. So I never did, obviously, go down to the office, but I walked downstairs. And I looked down Fifth Avenue, and there was no traffic all the way down. You could see some huge clouds of smoke when you realized what they were, but there wasn't a sound.
I was sitting here watching the television when the first plane went in.
Jack Butcher, bartender.
And I thought it was... this has happened before in New York, a plane went into the Empire State Building back when I was a kid. So my first inclination was that it was a plane that had just inadvertently made a mistake and crashed into the building.
I was on Greenwich Street walking to work.
Anne McGuire, immigrant and activist.
So I saw I heard the plane overhead. I heard this incredibly loud noise, and I actually stopped walking and crouched and put my hands over my ears because I had no idea what it was.
I was at home in Sunnyside and living with Sheena.
Katrina Hayes, immigrant, homemaker, and student nurse.
And the phone rang, and it was my brother Sean from Ireland, and he said that there'd been a plane crash or a helicopter crash into the World Trade Center, and I guess that it was about 8:30 or something, and I was getting up to get ready to go to work, because I used to be at work for about 10 o'clock, and I turned on the television, and I was kind of getting ready at the same time, and I suppose I didn't realize how serious it was, because I actually left the house and went to work. I got on the 7 train, and you can see downtown on the 7 train, and I could see that the buildings were on fire, you know, and everyone was looking out that side of the train, and you know, there was definitely a sense of, like, not fear as such, but like, you know, and I didn't feel like it was chaos or anything. But when I got out of Grand Central Station and I walked from Grand Central then to 47th and Madison, the streets were so quiet. It was eerie. And I was thinking, what is going on?
I was, you know, reading yesterday's paper and maybe writing in my diary or something like that.
Bridget Cagney, immigrant and 9/11 volunteer.
You know, expecting him to call, so I was not focused. So when he called and said, oh, turn on the television, there's something happening downtown, he said, and he had to go back. He was working in Brooklyn, and Knickerbocker Avenue was where he worked in Brooklyn. And so he said, I'm getting on the train now, but he said there's like something, he said a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center.
So clear in my memory how that morning went.
Jim Murphy, journalist.
It was beautiful out, and I live on 91st Street, just a block away from the kids' school, and I dropped my son off at Trinity, and I was supposed to have my checkup that morning. My doctor's over on Fifth Avenue, and it's so gorgeous that I'm walking. So I walked through the park. I was walking down Fifth, and I looked up. I was crossing over to her office. I was crossing Fifth Avenue, and I looked up, and I saw the black smoke, you know, because Fifth is sort of like a hill up there. So I'm really looking at it. I couldn't see the World Trade Center, but I saw this thick line of black.
When 9/11 happened, I was off.
Mary Murphy, journalist.
But I had to get into work, obviously. My mother called me. It was primary day. They were having the primary it was a Tuesday. And I had actually just come out of the shower and I went with wet hair to vote in the primary. And my car I had left it in Manhattan because the battery died or something. So my husband was driving me to get my car, and we didn't even make it to Flushing. My mother said, I thought she said the train in the World Trade Center. And I said, the train? She said, the plane. I said, no. She said, a plane went into the World Trade Center. So my husband raced me back to the house.
I then went to work for Bear Stearns as the head of global security, they call it.
Ray Kelly, New York City Police Commissioner.
Senior Managing Director. And I was only there for a short time, but while I was there, 9/11 happened. And I was having breakfast with the executives, at the company's headquarters on 46th Street, Park Avenue, at that time. Mm-hmm. Actually, they're in the process of building a new headquarters, which is a block away at this time. So I saw, we saw the first plane hit.
At that point, we were living where we're living now on Jane Street.
Frank Naughton, retired university professor.
We had a line of vision direct down to Manhattan. And we were both at home. I was scheduled to go to Kane University. Kane had become a university at that point. And I was scheduled to go, and I heard on the radio that there was a traffic delay because of an incident at the World Trade Center. So I delayed going and turned on the television and saw the second plane hit, the South Tower. All of the terrible things started happening.
When it happened, I was in the office and somebody mentioned that there was a plane that crashed into the World Trade Center.
John Ridge, historian.
I went outside on Fulton Street and you look right at the tower. It's only two blocks away. And I'm looking up at it and there was a crowd of people around there. And all of a sudden I see this figure falling from the tower, and I thought to myself, my God, that can't be a human being falling from that.
Walls are now on the attack. They come with a harsh, unnatural voice, a rasping volcano hurling boulders at us without aim. Only chance, says where they land, making nowhere safe. I am momentarily struck deaf. I do not hear the awful final roar of the tower in death. My mind blocks out the last sounds of the powerful collapse, the ripping, renting, relentless breakup raining down. But with all the growling and gnashing of its dentellations, I do not recall the cruel noise. I am deaf as I was to those voices crying vainly for help. Perhaps my hearing is deadened by the sight of so dark a vision of such destruction. Too great a suffering to absorb, too stimulating to accept, too overwhelming to possess. The wind does not blow the cacophony away as it did the voices from atop. The sound is present. I'm simply unable to hear it, but I cannot refuse to see it.
I had just finished a training video on high-rise fires.
Vince Dunn, retired New York City firefighter.
I said, I better do this training video before I forget, Mm-hmm. I finished this training video on how to fight a high-rise fire. So boom, I'm in the gym and I look at the TV set and I see this fire burning. Do a train set. I said, oh, this is going to burn for a couple of days. I said, you know, I said, firemen are probably just staying in the stairway, can't make the fire. Rescue guys are probably trying to help people down, not knowing that the damage of the building. So I said, you know, and then I see the other plane hit fall, and then I'm getting the picture. Still nothing. When I saw that structure come down, oh, God, I knew that. I mean, I knew what goes on in a high-rise building. I said, I know. So I just put my head in my hands. I said, oh, God, I know these guys are dying.
I was in the middle of the park when I heard Warner Wolf, a local sports commentator. He was talking to a talk show on the radio. He lived right next to the World Trade Center in a high-rise building, a couple blocks away, not right next to it. And he had witnessed the planes going past the window. He and his wife were sitting having coffee, and he noticed the first plane go in, and he saw the second. And I heard him, as I was in the park, I heard him say to Imus, he said, Imus, it's gone. And Imus said, what's gone? He said, the building is gone.
Once the first tower fell, which happened while we were all gathered in the this room that had windows out onto the towers burning, and then the first one collapsed. And the guy from HR was standing with his back to us, and he was saying, everyone is to stay in the building, no one is to go outside, and someone nearly choked me, actually. Someone behind me grabbed me from behind by the neck. She had, and I couldn't get her grip off me. She had gotten such a fright. She just grabbed.
My wife went to this. She was very upset, partly because she knew people who were working there. She immediately went out and went shopping for groceries and things she thought we might have, because no one knew how extensive the attack was going to be. And I went up on the roof at one point because she didn't come back, and I thought she had gone to the roof also. And I was able to look down and see, I think one of the towers had collapsed at that point. I was able to see the other tower burning, and I was able to see people on the street. And then went, you know, searching for Alice, who eventually came home. And then I remember hearing from the street this kind of collective groan. And I realized it was people on the street who were watching the remaining tower collapse.
After the fall of the second tower?
Bill McKimsey, immigrant and engineer.
There's only known 13 people to have survived that was inside after the fall of the second tower. And my son is one of them. He was a fireman.
Yeah.
And so 9/11 has a particularly poignant impact on me.
Our images of 9/11 are dominated by the two planes and the two towers that exploded in Lower Manhattan. But 200 miles to the south, a plane tore into the Pentagon and another crashed in the fields of Pennsylvania. Our collection of voices recall the dust, destruction, and emotion produced beyond the borders of the Battery.
Winds of hell scream in, a desert storm, a gritty, superheated Scirocco. It is lightless instantly. Only shadows of forms move before my eyes. It is less than night and less than day. I feel a reverberating silence. It is my new world I try to adjust. No longer do I see things as they are, but as through gauze. It is a miasma, a shaded reality. I reach out again. It is a wall. I search like a blinded man for a door. The dust presses me deeper. I do not see a thing, but feel along. I bounce and bump between hard objects I do not see at all.
So, I got out of that thing. I went home. I said, how did that building fall? I go back to my house, and I got a magazine article on the 93 bombing, you know, when the first terrorist attack. I remember reading the construction. What's the construction? So the guy, he says, this is radically different construction from any other high-rise building in America.
So the next day, I needed clothes, so I was able to make a phone call to the police department, and they took me down there, and we lived on the 16th floor, and so I went up and went into the apartment, and the apartment was just totally with white powder, even though I left the window open just a little bit. So just, you know, for me, it was just ferociousness of what happened, you know.
Mm-hmm. So I came back and watched it on television, disbelieving when the second one hit. And after about an hour, I went to the hospital, it's on Lexington Avenue, right here at 77th, and to give blood. And there were many of us there. And there wasn't a sound. And we kept waiting for the ambulances to come back. And they never did. And it wasn't until I got to the bar. I walked into the bar, and the bar was packed full of people. And it's like 10 o'clock in the morning, and we don't open until 12. And, you know, everyone is watching the television. You're thinking, shit, you know, it was amazing, really. And then, because they closed down all the trains and everything, you couldn't leave to go home. So our boss, Martin, came, and he was like, just serve people. Give them what they want. Give them what they need.
I went downstairs, and I just saw all these hundreds, I guess thousands of people streaming who had come across the 59th Street Bridge walking and were now walking all the way out to Queens all to get home and all of that. And so we watched that on the television.
Some black women next to me started praying. You know, I was praying too, because I saw this is an end of a human life right there before my eyes.
So I walked in. I had all those people, because the TVs were down in the bar room. I had over 200 people in my bar. Nobody drinking, nobody talking, just glued to these two TVs, and hundreds of people trying desperately to reach people that might have been in there, sons, daughters, mm-hmm. girlfriends, all cell phones weren't working, they were looking for landlines, it was just, and every window was filled outside with people staring in, looking at the TVs, it was just, and then the street filled up with people walking up from downtown, it was just, I was there all day, all night, I didn't leave until 11 o'clock that night. It's just, it was surreal.
And so we kind of formed into groups to make sure we were walking everyone home, or people who couldn't go home would come and stay somewhere or organize something, because none of the phones were working. So, and then we were basically cordoned off from 14th Street. Downtown was cordoned off. We couldn't get out. Get a newspaper the next day, and
there was dust. I remember the dust, like inches and inches and inches of, well, not dust, but just everywhere, blanketed, and paper everywhere, you know, that had survived the blast and the fire, I guess, but just, you know, office paper everywhere, and inches and inches and inches of just. And you just knew, you know, it was the remains of buildings and people, and it was everywhere, blanketed every car, every canopy outside, every surface, the ground. It was like there had been a war on Mars or the moon or something, you know. It was totally alien. We just went down to the restaurant, and, you know, over the morning people just started flooding in, with stories, you know, up there, and then nobody knew what was happening. Then there was, you know, the Pentagon has been bombed.
So anyhow, I get up and try to cross Memorial Bridge.
John Driscoll, politician and former National Guard officer.
Because I always walk to work every day, 3.5 miles, and I try to get across Memorial Bridge, and these special ops officers are coming back across and said, they got it closed, we can't cross here. So I went farther up the river and got to the Roosevelt Bridge. And there's no way to get up that on that bridge if you're walking. It's built for driving from that side of the river. So I had to climb up it like I was climbing a wall in my uniform. And I finally got up there and threw my leg over, and I start walking across the bridge. And that's, I swear to God, that entire town of Washington was evacuating. It was just a steady stream of traffic, all lanes. Everybody was talking on their cell phone. I'm the only one going into town. And
I stood in the middle of the bridge and had the Kennedy Center behind me, had the Lincoln Memorial, could see the Jefferson Monument, the Washington Monument, could see the Iwo Jima Monument, all the headstones in the Arlington Cemetery. I could see the plume of smoke, black smoke coming out of my office going up 10,000 feet, and I saw a guard intercepted with twin tails coming off of the airfield there at the National Airport. And he rolled over my office, looked down at my office. He was full load of ordnance, you know, rockets, bombs, the whole nine yards. And I remember thinking, if they ever make a movie about this, they better put the camera right here where I'm standing, because it was unbelievable.
It is not too trite to proclaim that we lost a lot that September morning. The physical destruction was obvious. The lives lost were irreplaceable. But the wounds cut deeper and forced us all to look a little closer at our neighbors, to pay more attention to the details of our day. Perhaps at no time before or since did the greeting, "How are you? How's everybody doing?" take on such significance.
A police officer with a grave and steady stare approaches the stunned man. Just then a woman, stumbling and in great pain, screams into the shrouded air, "My baby, my baby." It is a piercing cry, a dagger jab driven into the muffled silence. She struggles between walking and collapsing, moving robot-like toward the billowing, still standing, still burning, still killing tower. "My baby's there," she cries to no one, to all. The silent carpet walkers seem to notice not. But the police officer angles away from the man in shock, who still stares at his red legs, and he strides with a purpose toward the wailing woman. The policeman moves in front of the woman. He is a wall, blocking her path. He gestures as if saying, "Lady, lady, you can't." He is trying to help, but there is no reasoning with her. Crazed, she claws at him, she bites at him, she snarls until finally he grasps her wrists and forces her to her knees. She rests there, her face uplifted, crying, begging him to allow her to go. "My baby," she howls once more, a most unearthly scream. A voice to wake the heavens, a shout to part the shocked clouds of dust and damnation.
Americans that were lost that day, particularly with the firefighters and, of course, the police. It was just mind-boggling. And you just hear the bagpipes in the coming 6 months, and you knew exactly what they were. It was haunting. It was haunting. And it was tragic when you think of all the families that were that were disrupted.
What they had to do, I mean, that's what drove us down there. When we saw that these people were going in with their bare hands and searching for remains and dust and bringing it out, because they had all lost buddies, and some of these older farmmen had lost their sons, and they just didn't want to leave until they found something, some little piece of them, you know.
Photos everywhere, you know, photos of people hanging up photos, and that started looking for family members, and that had started that day, and you just knew it was so futile, you know.
In fact, my bus, I would get off my bus, my express bus, right in front of the World Trade Center. And that morning, I just had passed about a half an hour earlier. And the interesting thing from my neighborhood, which is Garretson Beach, it's predominantly Irish. On the express bus, there are two other people that get on the same stop with me every morning. And I know them only by first names, but I know they're Irish. So on September 11th, just like every morning, it's a routine. You get on that bus and you get off at the World Trade Center. I go east and they go west right into the World Trade Center. Never thought anything more of it. But that day, both of them were killed. And I think about that. What an awful thing. Just innocent people just minding their own business.
And then I remember, sadly, seeing people walking along the street just crying.
The evening of 9/11, our parish church in Bethesda, phone tree went around and said Mass at 8 o'clock.
Alice McDermott, author.
Oh, wow.
And the church was packed.
Like that. It was more crowded than, you know, Easter or Christmas. And people were crying, and people lingered outside. And it was, and again, at the time, it was just, yeah, I really, let's go to Mass, you know.
Yeah,
it's crazy. It's a Tuesday, but, you know, there's,
yeah.
And it was only looking back, I thought, what if you didn't have that?
In the days and years after the attacks in New York and Washington, we've all had time to reflect on what happened. What were the costs? Were there any gains? And how do we put it all into some kind of context, given all of our collective experiences here and for some of our interviewees in Ireland? 10 years have passed, and that mourning is with us still.
Amid a chorus of wailing eulogy, the survivors move away. I move with the living, yet I carry the dead, carry them on a funeral march beyond this September morning, this forever September morning.
353 firemen in one group marched up, and each one of them carrying a picture of one of the 353 that died. And then I think it was 12 o'clock, they stopped the entire parade. And all you heard was about face, and then the entire parade made an about face and faced downtown, and then for a minute you heard the city of New York without a sound.
The 9/11 stigma will always be with us, and the people lost on that day, you could never forget it. You could never forget it. I bet if you ask somebody from Northern Ireland who has lived through the Troubles, what their response was, I'm sure you get a different response. It would be much more, even more horrendous, you know?
Yeah.
Deja vu, you know?
I don't know. It's not until afterwards that you kind of realize the whole magnitude of it all. Like, at the time, I wasn't going out with Eddie, but I did try to call him on his pager or whatever and send him a message. But, you know, you just reach out to everybody, just to make sure that everyone is okay, you know. I think people were just more afraid in general, you know. Like, even going on the subway, I stopped taking the subway, I started taking the bus. Because, I just felt, and I still to this day hate being on the subway. I would take a bus anywhere, and even if it took me an extra 2 hours to get there, I'd take the bus, you know. Instead of getting on something that, you know, you're kind of stuck underground. It just freaked me out, you know.
And then you had people coming to help remember from England, Ireland, Canada, all over. Every state in the United States was sending people. And then they took to coming. It became a ritual that all these people who would go down would see us, and then on their way back from their shift, they would stop and they would just say, we just want to shake your hands and just tell you. And then that's what it became, you know. We were giving so little and they were giving so much, and then they began to think so much of us for the little tiny piece that we were doing, that it was like it was even too much for us. You know, we said, we're doing nothing. He said, oh no, you don't know. You're the only human beings that we see. And just the encouragement, and the day that you're not there, I mean, the day that we come by and you're not there, we'll just say, it's all over. And we said, no, when you give up, we'll give up.
You know, I remember it really sort of gave me a flashback to Northern Ireland, or, you know, feeling that vulnerable, being Irish in London, or, yeah, and just being in the restaurant, everyone coming in, and all their stories about where they were when it happened, and then watching the towers falling. And
that was a real Irish event, unfortunately, because when I looked at the New York Times, I saw that every second name seemed to be Irish. And interesting, because, you know, they were in jobs that probably paid way above average. They were at the top of the finance community. They were doing really well. They were achievers, and yet so many of them were Irish. It pointed out how good or how well the Irish have done in this country, but unfortunately they were the victims to a disproportionate amount.
Well, I came here, and any time I saw a duffel bag or anything around the place, just sitting there, I would go to security in the building before any of this happened, because I was so used to, you know, if you see boxes or bags or anything like that anywhere, you know, there's something wrong, you go tell somebody. Or I also was scared. I would notice I was walking down the street and then I would think, Jesus Christ, this car could just blow up. Mm. You know, which is just not, I mean, it's irrational, but, you know, I did have those kind of panicked moments before September 11th. So, I mean, this was just, I don't even know how to describe it. It was totally traumatizing.
You know, after 9/11. Mm-hmm.
Mary McMullen, immigrant and bookkeeper.
Definitely, you know, people, if you were Islamic,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you had to really fear for your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been, I would see a parallel. And not all, I mean, we were attacked by, you know, Islamics, but it's not all Islamics are terrorists.
Well, one of the things I remember is I got two phone calls from Ireland, cousins, who we had visited in Ireland, and one of whom had visited us here in the city, and they wanted to make sure we were okay, which I thought was enormously sweet of them.
I took her back to a roof, and we looked down on the World Trade Center. It was just such a jolting sight for her and for me. You know, she was crying, of course.
But one thing that struck me is being in Ireland on September 11th, Patricia Meskel, Event Services Coordinator for the Marriott at the World Trade Center. Then I realized I really was an American. And I love Ireland, but I was really wanted to be back in New York, probably because of the fact of where I had worked. And I live in Manhattan and everything that was happening. But I am an American. But would I, with a very strong connection to Ireland.
The dead from here are my forever companions. I am their pine box, their marble reliquary, their bronze urn, the living, breathing coffin they never had, their final resting place without a stone. I move on. Thank you.
For Glucksman Ireland House, this is Linda Dowling Almeida.
Last week, my colleague Anne Solari came in and told us about some of the events that we have coming up. I would like to draw your attention to the first public event of our fall series. These are two events that will take place on Saturday, September 13th, Lá Ghaeilge, an Irish Language Day. This is an opportunity to discover the beauty of the Irish language in a program designed for learners of all levels. It is led by NYU's Paul Ferris, Hilary Vaxivna, Padraig O'Carroll, and Shane O'Rourke. It'll run from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Following on that evening at 7 p.m. on the 13th of September, we have the opportunity to meet the oldest surviving Blasket Islander, a 93-year-old Micheál Ócárna, Dr. Michael Carney. He'll be interviewed by Padraig O'Carroll in Irish about life on the island, the evacuation of the island in 1953, and his recent memoir, From the Great Blasket to America, which will be available for purchase that night. That event is in Irish. It's As Gaeilge. We'd invite as many as possible to come to hear the lovely Blasket Irish of Micheál Ócárna. It's a real honour and privilege to have an opportunity to hear him speak. For any information on our public events, please email us at ireland.house@nyu.edu or call us on 212-998-3950. And every week I'll give you updates as to what's coming up in terms of events at Luxman Ireland House or related academic events that I'd like to draw your attention to. For those of you interested in the history of the Great Irish Famine, and any of you interested in Leitrim history, I'd like to draw your attention to an event which will take place on Sunday, September 7th. Dr. Maureen Murphy of Hofstra University will launch a new book by Dr. Gerard McItasney. The book is entitled The Dead Buried by the Dying, The Great Famine in Leitrim. This event will take place in the Manhattan Room at Rosie O'Grady's on 7th Avenue at 5 p.m. If you'd like some more information, please call 917-751-8154 or 914-693-8888. We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, please email us at ireland.house@nyu.edu or call 212-998-3950. If you would like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.